You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and believe it or not, Glenn Beck tried to sound rational. On his radio show Monday, he spoke out arguably against the protesters and militia members at the Bundy Ranch in Nevada, who were seemingly trying to drum up an armed conflict with federal and state law enforcement officials. Beck urged them to use a peaceful approach, not to resort to violence. Check it out.
I am fully clear on what the federal government wants to do. With that being said, no matter how clear I am on these things, the answer is not violence.
Glenn Beck urging peaceful protests in Nevada didn't sit well with his fans and other members of the far right. One person wrote on his Facebook wall that, "Glenn, you are no longer a friend of the patriots fighting for freedom. Go away and sell some books and your false bravado to other traitors. How about you? How about you yourself said this tyranny was coming and did not stand up? Reread Article 1, Bundy is a hero." And then another fan of Beck's wrote, "When the possibility of bloody conflict exists, does Beck simply roll over and side with the oppressor, the tyrannical state?" The outrage of Beck's fans raises an interesting question. Why is Beck preaching peace and not supporting the militia members down in Nevada? It might be because he knows just how dangerous they and other members of the far-right extremist movement, how these guys can be just totally crazy. On her show last night, Rachel Maddow chronicled the rise of far-right extremism over the past two decades and noted that homegrown right-wing extremists have carried out more domestic terror attacks than jihadists, than Muslims, since 9/11. According to the New America Foundation, 21 people have been killed in attacks motivated by Islamic extremism since 9/11. 34 people have been killed by right-wing extremism since 9/11. Here in the United States, fact is, right-wing extremist militia groups are on the rise. They're dangerous, and now they're a major force in America. They're not the splinter groups, the sliver groups that they used to be. Now, I've been looking into this more and more. I just watched a Fox News documentary that seemed to correlate with the start of this whole thing. And there's a couple of really interesting kind of moving parts that I see to all of this that's going on. First of all, you know, there's this massive multi-year, arguably generational drought that's been going on out west. And when drought happens, you can have fewer cattle on the same amount of land. Because, I mean, they're ruminants. They're going around eating anything that's got any moisture in it. And if you got a drought, there's not much left. And so the overgrazing starts happening really, really rapidly. And we're seeing ranches that are managed by the Bureau of Land Management around the country. In many cases, the BLM is coming in and saying, we're dialing back. And I don't see anybody talking about this as a global warming issue, but I'll bet you it is. And I'll bet you that the administration and the BLM and, you know, the powers that be and whatnot are reluctant to talk about it in those terms, because that's a whole other thing that the right wing will blow. What? You're taking a conspiracy theory about global warming and using it to take my cattle away or my grazing rights away? So, number one. And then number two, this meme. I've been reading right-wing websites for the last couple of days. Wow. And there is a really well done video out there that has just absolutely gone viral. And it's got, you know, this kind of sky over a old grainy film effect and a guy with a very credible, very professional voice saying, you know, there's some crazy conspiracy theories out here. And then he names a couple of them. And he says, we should just set that stuff aside because we lose credibility. But what about the stuff that might actually be true? And then he builds this really seemingly credible and compelling case saying, let's look at Reuters and CBS News and what the BLM said on their own website. And builds this case that the Bundys are being the Bundy Ranch is losing their rights to graze cattle on federal land because Harry Reid's son is a lobbyist for a solar company, and they have leased land from the BLM or from the federal government anyway, and so this is all about the Reid family getting rich. This video is a very, very personal attack on Harry Reid. And I'll bet you there's not a right winger involved in this thing who hasn't seen it. And the production values on it, I'm looking at this thing going, who's got the time or money to do something this good? This is really well done. And it looks a little homemade, but anybody who's ever been involved in video production, one of the things you learn is that to make something look like it was just thrown together can be the most expensive way to do it. If you're, with a good production quality, the production quality on this is stunning. And all this stuff about and by the way, it's not true. I mean, first of all, yeah, his son did represent a solar company. They were negotiating for some land, but it was 35 miles away from this ranch. It was a whole different place. They somehow neglect to point that out. And the deal fell through. And all of that was relatively recent, and this family has not been paying. Well, they were ordered off the land back in 98. That was 16 years ago. Long before Harry Reid's son even ever got involved in the solar business, long before the Chinese solar companies were even around. This has gotten, one has nothing to do with the other. Even Snopes has now debunked this. But right after Harry Reid started attacking the Koch brothers from the floor of the Senate, this really slick production came out and went viral about how it's all about Harry Reid getting rich. Or his family. So this is the new form of corruption. You don't just give money to a politician. You give it to their brothers and their sisters and their family. And I'm not suggesting the Koch brothers funded or financed or decided to do this video. But the timing is just really weird. And the message is really weird. And then on top of that, you got Sean Hannity out there basically getting ready for a war. How long is that mashup? Do we have time right now? No, we don't. Okay. I got it. Sean Hannity last night had Cliven Bundy on and had his son on too, didn't he? And he was saying to his son, what are you going to do if the federal officials come in the middle of the night with, presumably with guns drawn? How are you going to protect your father? Basically, he was asking, will you please on the air tell everybody you're going to start shooting at federal officials? And he was going all Alien Gonzalez on him. This thing is getting larger and more complicated and we'll see where it goes.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But I think it's a symptom of how very powerful interests can distort the public discourse very easily. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Andrew Campbell, the senior producer with The Big Picture, on the line with us. Hey, Andrew, how you doing today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. We're going to start out tonight with Pap, and is Sean Hannity going to get somebody killed?
Yeah, we'll be talking about what you just gave your loan rant on, what's the latest down in Nevada, and we'll also get into the the conservative talking points that have been floated around about a possible Harry Reid connection to all of this. And really, isn't this just a whole big ploy by the Koch brothers to get Reid out of the Senate and to really discredit him? So it'll be interesting to see what Pap has to say about that.
I think there's a whole lot of, you know, look at the right hand while the left hand is picking your pocket. But, you know, who knows? It'll be interesting to see what Pap has to say. Then we're going to do the Lone Liberal Rumble with Chris and Horace.
Yep, we have Chris and Horace on. We'll touch on the Bundy Ranch saga. We'll also talk about Vermont passing a new GMO bill. And when is the rest of the country going to follow suit? And are big agriculture interests ever going to let Americans know what's actually in their food?
Right.
We'll talk about a new study about CEO pay being 332-1 versus average worker pay. That's from the AFL.
Wow, compared to 30-1 when I was your age.
Exactly. It's
amazing.
Really mind-boggling. We'll talk about Ted Yoho's recent comments, a lawmaker down in Florida who had some not-so-great things to say about the Civil Rights Act, so we'll be getting into that as well. We'll also touch on, do conservatives want America to be more like China, where there's really no labor laws and no minimum wage? It seems like they do, so that's an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll also finish up by...
Well, you got this one state where the governor just said, you know...
Oklahoma.
Yeah, Oklahoma.
Yep. Passed a ban on any sort of minimum wage increase.
Yep.
And then we have Dick Morris saying that Democrats, not Republicans, but Democrats, are trying to rig the Electoral College so that they can secure power. Kind of interesting coming from Dick, but we'll get into that with Chris and Horace.
Yep. Okay.
And then in Block D, we have... We're still efforting, I guess, but we hopefully will have someone on from Washington University. Some students recently protested fossil fuels and big oil. It was part of a We Are the Power Shift movement, so it'll be interesting to get one of them on and see really how college students can help lead the transition to a clean and green economy and really fight back against climate change.
Yeah. It should be very interesting. And then our daily take is this rant I've been off on. I mean, I wrote a whole book about this called Screwed. Basically, a middle class made up of working people. A middle class made up of professionals is the normal thing in capitalism. But a working class made up of working people is abnormal in capitalism.
Exactly. You've done a lot of work on this, and it's really an interesting thing to get into. What is the middle class, and it should be a great daily take.
Yeah, and how do middle classes come about? What makes them happen? I mean, you know, the reality is that a society has to make a decision that they are going to tax the very rich if they're going to have a middle class, and if they don't want to tax the very rich, eventually their working class middle class will vanish. They'll still have a middle class made up of professionals, doctors, lawyers, and shop owners, and professionals and mercantilists, but no more working people in the middle class. And that's frankly, I think that's where we're at right now. Andrew Campbell, producer of The Big Picture. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks.
So I'll see you tonight. Welcome back, Tom Harbin here with you. You know, at the same time, you look at all these states where ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, another Koch brothers funded organization, or in part, you know, supported by, all around the country is trying to make it harder to vote. You would think if conservatives were on the rise, if they were winning the war of ideas, as it were, in America, that they would be trying to make it easier to vote. I mean, you'd think that, right? There's also, it looks to me like the whole conservative thing has fallen apart, frankly. That, you know, 33 years of Reaganomics now, we've been, you know, the Reagan Revolution was a real revolution, just like the FDR Revolution was a real revolution. The FDR Revolution overthrew the power of the rich and turned working people in America into the middle class. Now, in Europe, they understand the difference between the working class and the middle class. Because for centuries, there was a difference between the two. The working class was the working, what we call the working poor. And the middle class was what we would call doctors and lawyers. And the middle class made enough that they could live and they could set a little aside and they could retire and they could, you know, work a 40-hour week and have a comfortable life. And the working class worked 50, 60, 70 hours a week, 80 hours a week, two people in the family worked, and they just barely got by and they were in debt their whole lives. And they were renters rather than homeowners. And that's the way capitalism normally functions. And we're almost now completely back to that in the United States. This is how it was in the United States prior to 1900. The last half of the 19th century was like this during the Gilded Age. But FDR changed the rules of the game. He raised the top tax on rich people to 91%. Teddy Roosevelt put into place an inheritance tax. And so all that money, rather than accumulating at the top as it normally does, started flowing downstream so that working people who would otherwise be the working poor became the middle class. And we built this giant middle class in the United States. And that middle class is being dismantled right now. There was an amazing piece I was reading last night in the New York Times. At some length, they went through how in town after town after town in America, you can no longer afford on the average working person's salary, on the median salary in those towns. And we're not just talking New York and San Francisco here. We're talking, you know, dozens, maybe 100 cities in America, virtually everywhere. That people, you know, if you figure that rent should be a third of your income, no longer can people afford rent. Humble rent. And, you know, this trend is picking up steam. And it's just, you know, it's just one of, you look at that, you look at credit card debt. Now is you know, pushing $1 trillion. Student loan debt is over $1 trillion. The average two-wage earner household today is bringing home the same amount of money that a one-wage earner household brought home the year that Ronald Reagan became president. The 400 richest people in America pay less than 20% on their income taxes on average, whereas a working person pays, you know, I mean, it's just, it's like the richer, they're not paying their taxes. They're taking huge sums of money. And the working class is no longer able to stay in the middle class. They're going, you know, we're moving back to an era of the working poor in the United States. Thomas Piketty, who's a French economist, wrote a book about this it's been a big deal in Europe now for the last year. It's just been translated into English. It just came out in the last couple of weeks here in America. In the United States, Martin Wolf just reviewed it for the Financial Times. It's called Capital in the 21st Century. And he talks about how he says economics is a subdiscipline of the social sciences alongside history, sociology, anthropology, and political science. I would agree with that. And he points out that a middle class is not a normal thing outside of doctors, lawyers, and mercantilists, shop owners. That's your normal middle class. But for working people to be part of the, quote, middle class, that's not a normal thing in a normal capitalist economy. Capitalism has no provision for that. And so a society has to decide that they're going to do that. And the way that you decide in a society to do that is you tax the rich. If we wanted to go back to having the working class in America become the middle class, all we'd have to do is roll back the Reagan tax cuts, basically roll back Reaganomics. Because the working class was the middle class 35 years ago. Ain't no more. Now, you combine this massive loss of income by working class people all across the United States. So lots and lots of people know that they're being screwed. They don't know exactly how or why, but they know that they're being screwed compared to their parents' generation or even their grandparents' generation. You combine that with a climate change drought out west that's causing the federal government to have to start saying to ranchers, you know, you got too many cows on this land. There's just no water anymore. You got to dial it back. And those ranchers fighting back. And then you toss in an explosive talk show host like Sean Hannity. I forgot to play the damn clip for you. I will do that when we come back from the break. I'll play that clip and then I'll take your calls on this. But I'm seeing here a perfect storm. The destruction of the middle class, the squeeze on the working class, on working people, the moving of our jobs overseas, and climate change.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And I'm seeing this perfect storm being exploited by billionaires like the Koch brothers through Americans for Prosperity and billionaires like Rupert Murdoch through Fox so-called news. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, okay, as promised, this, I'm a talk show host. I've been doing this for a decade. I've been in the business since I was 16 years old. I mean, on or off. I worked in radio for 10 years and then got out of it and then got back into it 10 years ago. But I've been around the block. And I know that you can ask people questions in ways that elicit the kind of responses you want. Without a lot of effort. And frankly, I got to wonder what kind of answers Sean Hannity was trying to get out of the Bundy family last night with this interview. Here, this is a slice and dice. Shane chopped up the interview, so you're just going to hear the Hannity part. Basically, the restraint that was shown by the Bundy family was admirable. They basically did not take the bait. They did not say we're going to, you know, shoot federal officers. They didn't go all G. Gordon Liddy, you know, where remember the famous Watergate burglar and right-wing talk show host talked about how, you know, if you're going to shoot a federal agent, go for the head because they got body armor on and all that kind of crazy. So none of that happened. Instead, it was a fairly rational response. But the questions, just listen to this. You make up your own mind.
God forbid. I mean, we saw the raid, for example, back with Elian Gonzalez. I'm not sure if you remember that raid. What would happen if they came in the early morning hours one day to your ranch? Well, he also said, Richard Mack, is I don't think it would be possible to launch a raid without violence. If they came to arrest you, would you surrender? The sheriff speaking, Harry Reid speaking, and you hear all this. What are your plans? I would assume as Cliven's son, you want to protect your dad. What are your plans if, in fact, they come late in the night? Do you worry that, in fact, they may kill either your dad or somebody in your family?
I mean, these are the kind of things that you ask if you're trying to get somebody to say something that, I mean, if somebody said to me, what would you do if somebody thought they were going to kill Louise? It's not impossible that I would say I would try to kill them first. Or not just Louise. I mean, you know, Louise or any of my kids. That's instinctual. Why do you ask those kind of questions on television, in front of the world? It's like unless you're trying to start a war. Or maybe he's just so desperate to jack his ratings. I don't know. Anyhow. Catherine in Madison, Wisconsin, you have some thoughts on this. Catherine.
Okay. Alec always...
The American Legislative Exchange Council? Alec?
Council always comes in with a bill, and what they always tell us is they're trying to make it fair and equitable across the state. It's always taking away the working class person, the middle class person's rights, like renter's rights. We have no more here.
In Wisconsin, you've lost renter's rights?
Oh, yeah. Three different bills.
Wow.
They say at the tenants that they haven't seen things they in decades.
Uh-huh.
But that's not where I want to go with it. That's kind of what they do, okay?
Right.
Alec's new agenda is solar and water. And what they're saying is they want to provide a bright and equitable future. They want to take away your ability to have solar panels on the roof and not be in the grid and not pay into the corporations.
Sure.
And so I think, and plus personally, I think the Kochs want a civil war. I think they feel that they're in a position to come out on top and be running the country totally or split off a part of the country and keep it for themselves. I think there's an agenda maybe even behind the Kochs.
Well, I think there's an element of billionaire secessionism in the United States. And I mean, that basically, if you read Atlas Shrugged, Ayn Rand's opus magnum that Paul Ryan used to require all his staff members to read, that's the storyline. The billionaires got sick and tired of dealing with the union officials and the crybaby workers and the government bureaucrats who had standards that the railroad had to operate by, and they said screw this, and the billionaires all left and went off and started joined up with John Galt and started their own little utopia, and as a consequence of the billionaires leaving, the country fell apart. That's the storyline, the entire storyline of Atlas Shrugged. And Alice shrugged and the country collapsed. Well, I suspect if all the billionaires left, there's a lot of entrepreneurs who would step up to the plate and say, okay, all the billionaires who own Apple are gone. I'll I can invent computers. And I mean, fill in the blanks, right? I mean,
I think there's a lot of creative things that will go on. I don't know if you've read about the corporation Warby Parker, who decided that eyeglasses shouldn't be $700.
Yeah. I bought a pair of glass frames, actually, from Warby Parker for $99.
Well, you know that they're doing socially responsible corporate.
Yeah, I read the about the company thing.
And then you have all the cooperatives. You actually had a cooperative, I don't know if it's still existing, that was making solar panels in Ohio that was worker-owned.
Right.
Now, Ohio's just come out with saying that it's illegal to have sick pay or to raise the minimum wage.
No, it's Oklahoma.
Oh, Oklahoma, excuse me.
Yeah.
But I think the solar thing is in Ohio.
Yeah.
So basically what you're doing is you're demonizing the person on the bottom who's trying not to be owned by the corporation.
Yeah, yeah. It's absolutely what's going on. This is a class war, as Warren Buffett, I believe, said, and his class is, I think, was it Buffett or Soros said, this is a class war, my class is winning? I think it was Buffett, too, yeah. Catherine, thank you for the call. Good points. All. Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick.
Yeah, I really think that Sean Hannity is trying to cite civil unrest and do it in such a way that he couldn't be held liable. It's like all them nut jobs over Fox News are itching for something like that. And we know a confrontation like that there's no way the ranchers and those people would even come out ahead. There's no way. And then that give more fuel to claim the Obama administration's a tyrant. Well, when in fact, if they were tyrants, they'd already shut down Fox News because they're telling deliberate lies and misleading the people that watch that show. I know a lot of people that are seemingly intelligent, except when it comes to politics and in the real picture. And it's just, it amazes me. I've had to really end friendships when somebody uses the N-word referring to Obama or poor people or whatnot. I wasn't born in this state. I was born in Maryland, right on the D.C. border. I went to integrated schools. And this is ridiculous. Now, I don't understand their reasoning or their thinking.
If the wealthy people can keep the formerly middle class, now working poor people fighting against each other, and particularly if they can make, for example, working people working for private companies hate working people who are working for government agencies, or working people who don't have unions hate people who do have unions. If they can keep that going, then nobody talks about how the billionaires are scamming us all. And that's what's going on, Rick. That's what's going on. Thanks for the call. Well said. Jane in Round Mountain, California. Hey, Jane, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You were saying a little while ago how this thing in Nevada is just getting bigger and bigger and, growing. I want to put kind of a microscope on it, and it's, I guess in some ways, I think it's a small issue. To me, it's not because I'm very much animal rights person.
Right.
But I live in northeastern California, And I recall years ago, I don't know, maybe 10, maybe longer, that BLM was rounding up the wild horses.
They're still doing
it. The wild burros. Yeah, well, okay, this is what I'd like to know, because I'm not completely up to date. Anyway, they would round them up and they bring them to some state prison, so they'd have the inmates break them in, and then they would sell them or whatever it was, you know, for people to adopt.
Right.
Now, I heard that recently they stopped doing that and that they're just shooting them from helicopters from the air.
Yeah, I don't know that they're shooting them from helicopters, but they are. I believe that they are killing them. And in fact, there's been talk about, I think there is a meat factory that exports to Europe, horse meat for Europe. It's a, you know, it's actually a big deal there. And again, I mean, here's the problem with I had Madeline Pickens on this show, and you know, T Boone's wife, and she's really, really big in trying to protect the horses and save them from the BLM out west. And here's the problem. Horses are not indigenous to North America. Europeans brought them, we brought them with us. The Spaniards specifically brought them over here in the early 1600s. So you take a non-indigenous, an invasive species basically. And yeah, they're beautiful and sweet and all that. And it's like, you know, who wants to shoot a kitten, right? And by the way, you know, look at how cats are clearing away songbirds. So, you know, one cat will clear a square mile of, kill all the birds in the area. And which is why people need to spay and neuter their cats and keep them indoors. But you can't spay and neuter horses, wild horses, and keep them indoors. And then you take drought and rangeland and you get too many horses on it, just like you get too many cattle on it. These are ruminants, and they just destroy the land. And so if the BLM is charged with keeping the land in reasonable shape, then they're stuck between a rock and a hard place, because eventually those horses are going to, and in fact do, overpopulate to the point where, you know, the horse population doesn't start to crash until they first crash the biosphere around them, the ecosystem around them. And I don't see any clean or easy solutions to any of this. It's just, it's like, you know, deer in the woods in Vermont. Jane, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the BLM finds themselves, you know, in this very difficult position, particularly given the drought that's happening. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dave in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. Hey, Dave, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. You are on the air.
Hi, Tom. I read the Piketty thing, and I think it was on your own message board there. Somebody linked it.
Mm-hmm.
And I also read...
You're talking about the one about Harry Reid and all that?
No.
Oh, okay.
It was his capitalism version.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And there's a similar one by a lady from India. I think her name is Aberanti Roy.
Right.
I may have the first name. Do you know her?
I don't know her personally, but I've read her, been reading her writings for years and years. A lot of her stuff gets picked up over at Common Dreams on a regular basis.
Okay, well, this is an essay that really paints a pretty ugly picture of India. It's supposed to be the largest democracy in the world. Right. And boy, I tell you, it's a cautionary tale. If we're going down that road, it's scary. It's corporatocracy to the max.
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, India has been going through Reaganomics kind of neoliberalism over the last couple of decades, just like the United States has over the last three decades. They used to have, for example, a law in India, and I've spent a fair amount of time in India. I have some familiarity with the country, and I've been going over there since the late 70s. And they used to have a law in India that said that no company or family could own more than two retail outlets in the country. And so the entire retail sector was small local businesses, and which employed millions of people. And they just blew that up a couple of years ago. And now Walmart and all the big chains are moving into India and all the, you know, and they did the same thing with agriculture and farming 15, 20 years ago. And you had, you know, Monsanto and the big ag companies moved in. And now you've got small farmers, you know, moving off the land and into the cities, and so the slums are exploding, or simply staying on the farms and committing suicide. Suicide among farmers is an epidemic in India right now.
A quarter of a million of them.
Yeah, Yeah. And you can track all that back to, you know, to industrial agriculture practices. And now you're starting to see suicides among the former small shop owners, people who thought that they were the middle class, you know, that they were the Indian, the top end of the Indian working class. And now they've got nothing because Walmart's eating their lunch, which is, you know, what happened in, you know, all across America, small town America, well, even large town America over the last
year. Just a little bit behind them on the evolutionary scale.
Yeah. Well, it's on the predatory scale. What you're seeing in India, frankly, what you're seeing in Russia and many of the former Eastern European countries or the Eastern European countries, former Soviet states that have adopted Chicago School neoliberal economics, what you're seeing in parts of Southern Europe, what you're seeing in the UK and what you're seeing in the United States to a smaller extent is a move more and more to the right, more and more toward libertarian economics. At the same time, you got countries like Chile, most of South America, and Northern Europe who are moving more and more to the left, saying we don't want to have anything to do with that. And their quality of life is improving, and our quality of life has fallen off the cliff. In their countries, their billionaires are reducing in number, and the middle class is growing. In our country, and in India, and in these in the Eastern European countries, the number of billionaires is increasing, and the number of working people who are in the middle class is collapsing. And you would think that the world could put two and two together, but as long as they can keep us fighting each other and keep asking questions like, what are you going to do when the guys from the government with guns show up in the middle of the night, they can keep us, you know, they think they can keep us off balance. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I think it's a strong lesson for progressives from this incident with the ranch. I seen one of the militias saying that they put their woman on the front line.
Well, no, wait a second. That was Sheriff Mack, who we had on as a guest on the show yesterday, and he said words to that effect the day before that on Fox News. And what he was saying was that if they wanted to do it in a PR fashion to show how brutal the government could be, and the government was going to shoot, that the women should be on the front line. And I think he on our program yesterday, he said, you know, they took out of context what I said, and I shouldn't have said it, basically. So, you know, let's recognize the humanity of all involved here.
I think it's a good idea because it would be an upgrade on Gandhi and Martin Luther King peaceful protests.
Mm-hmm.
They've been using saboteurs, provocateurs, and snipers in all the revolutions around the world.
But see, here's the thing, Jesse.
Violent.
Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi were saying, we are going to stand here and let you beat the crap out of us because we want to have the rights of citizens. The Bundy family is saying we want to be able to fatten cattle on public land and then sell it and keep all the money ourselves. That's a very different message.
The point is, it's a protest, whichever way you look at it.
No, it's a protest, but you know there are some protests that are sympathetic and others that aren't. And Fox News is trying to turn the Bundy protest into a sympathetic protest.
No, but the progressives could turn it away. They could make a positive out of it. What I'm saying is the Federal Reserve is the Achilles heels of the rich.
No, it's not.
Democracy is the Achilles heels of the 99%.
That's true.
If we want to use this to our advantage, we could use poor women and children, occupy the Fed, demand that we get our bailout and have a divorce from private ownership of the Fed.
Yeah. Okay. I get your tactic suggestion, Jesse. I don't agree with it, but I understand what you're saying and I understand why. Thanks a lot for the call. David in Addison, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, David.
Hey. Yeah, actually, I'm kind of going to attack a little minor point here. You suggest this a lot on your show that we need to roll back to pre-Reagan taxation.
Yes, sir.
As some sort of solution to our economic problems.
Yeah.
So what you're saying, just so I can be clear here, is that you want to have the top marginal tax rate hit 70% again, correct?
74%, yes.
But you do realize that that would be economically catastrophic demonstrably in this current economy, right?
If that's the case, why did the United States not collapse when we had the top tax rate at 91%? For three decades, and my grandfather and father had very nice middle class lives. Thank you very much.
Because we had an extremely different economic climate. And to compare our economic climate from decades ago to the current climate would be as ridiculous.
So you're saying that because we're allowing American workers to compete with Vietnamese workers or Chinese workers, therefore billionaires shouldn't have to pay high tax rates. That makes absolutely no friggin' sense to me at all.
Well, you know what makes no sense to me, though? And here, you want it to be 75% tax rate. You know, France did that a year ago, right?
France, you're talking about the country where one person working a 40-hour work week can support an entire family, where everybody has free health care, arguably the best in the world, certainly the top three, where everybody can retire at the age of 63 on a full pension and spend the rest of their lives comfortably retired with full health care, where everybody in the country takes a three-week vacation every year that's fully paid, where people have months of maternity leave paid maternity leave. Is that the France you're talking about?
I'm actually talking about the France where economic creativity has stagnated since the new taxes have been implemented.
France's economy is doing a hell of a lot better than ours.
The entrepreneurs and
David, I'm willing to bet you've never been to France.
I've actually been several times. I used to work and live in Europe for a long time.
But if you have lived in Europe, how can you possibly be arguing that the American standard of living is better than the European standard of living right now?
Oh, I'm not arguing that. I'm arguing that Europe is insustainable, especially France. And this is backed up not just by what I'm saying, but the French president said this at the beginning of this year, that the taxes were a mistake. They're on the verge of an economic crisis. Entrepreneurship and businesses are hemorrhaging from that country, and their unemployment is steadily on the rise, currently at 11 or 12%. I'm not sure what it is off the top of my
head. And let me tell you the reason why. It's because of the European Union. It's because France joined the EU, and they never should have. And the United States is not a member of anything similar to the EU. Although I do think, you know, apropos of our earlier conversation, I do think that we need to get out of NAFTA and CAFTA and SHAFTA and all the other free trade agreements and go back to doing what, you know, the Germans are doing so well, what the Chinese are doing so well, what the Japanese are doing so well, what the South Koreans are doing so well. And that is basically having a 20 to 30% import tariff on our products, on products brought into the United States, so that we bring manufacturing back home. But that's, you know, that would be, again, that's rolling back Reaganomics, too. Reagan started this whole free trade thing in a big way with most favored nation status, pushing that through so that we would have these bilateral trade deals that then Bill Clinton took international, multilateral with NAFTA. You know, with Mexico and Canada, and then signing the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades in 1996, and starting the World Trade Organization in 1997,
Let's step back for a second here. You're saying France's participation in the EU is what's causing their current economic collapse.
Actually, they're the second or third largest political party in the country. That's the core of their message. Yes, because they no longer control their currency and because they no longer control their trade policy. If other countries in the European Union drop their taxes, and then French billionaires leave. It's the same problem we have in the United States. It's this race to the bottom. We have in the United States, you've got like Boeing saying to their workers in Washington State, okay, you guys are unionized and you're making a good wage. We don't like that. Screw that. We're going to go to South Carolina or Mississippi. And when you can play one state off against another like that, the workers always lose. And at the end of the day, ultimately the country loses. And, you know, that's what's happening with all of Europe. The European Union is leaving. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And the, you know, from the range wars to the, which we will get back to in a minute, to the lunchroom wars. And I'm not sure how ferocious those are, but Charlie Kirk is on the line with us, the founder and executive director of Turning Point USA. The website is turningpointusa.net. And I'm looking at your homepage here, Charlie. Fascinating stuff. Hey, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So you've got this movement here, this hashtag that you're pushing out, hashtag lunch movement, with one simple message: no more Mrs. Obama. That has to do with school lunches. Tell me about it.
Sure. Yeah, we have high school chapters and college chapters all across the country, and what we started to realize, a lot of our members were tweeting out pictures of disgusting food in just outrageous fashion, you know, on Twitter and Facebook. We said, hey, consolidate this together and start a hashtag to kind of, you know, so we can synthesize this and see if there's other students that are doing the same thing. And what we saw was a true grassroots resistance to these new school lunch programs. And it's an admirable cause that Mrs. Obama's putting forth. It's very noble. You know, childhood obesity is an epidemic, and we need to have our children, you know, eating nutritious foods. If we want them to learn, how are we expecting them to learn if they are have empty stomachs and, you know, if they're hungry? But what we've seen is, you know, a disastrous policy be put forth in these schools, and the food is terrible. If you've seen some of these pictures, it's stale chicken sandwiches with like a half kiwi. And what's happening is the kids are just throwing the food away, and they're leaving school hungry than when they got there.
Okay, let's start at the beginning here. First of all, I'm assuming, given your concern about this, that as a predicating assumption, you believe that every school in America should be providing every student with a free lunch?
Not necessarily free lunch from a federal government standpoint, but, you know, to take the assumption, I'll take the cause that it's important that if we want to make education a priority, that our students are not hungry in the classroom. The methodology of doing that should be an open and debatable discussion. I won't necessarily.
Well, what's your solution if you don't want everybody in the country to have a free school lunch? What do you want? Just the rich kids,
right,
to be able to buy a lunch?
No. I think that a good policy prescription is put this in the hands of creative principals and localized school districts.
Well, you're a creative guy. What's your solution?
Right. So let's look at some success stories, you know, across the country. Other schools that have been able to get block funding and go to more private systems for school lunches are having much.
So your solution is to privatize the school lunch program.
No, I think that we shouldn't have federal regulations or mandates. I'm not gonna say I have all the answers, and I'm not. I'm not an education policy expert. But we are into empowering students, and what is.
Okay, so if we privatize the school lunch programs and we turn it all over to McDonald's, for example, how is that going to accomplish the goal that you stated earlier of having American kids eat good food so that we can reverse this obesity epidemic and so that their brains will work?
Well, so take two steps back. Again, I'm not going to say that privatized all the way is the solution, but you can't dispute what's going on right now is working, which is new federal regulations, you know, these ladle size requirements. You're seeing schools opt out, poor and rich schools, and poor school districts in Chicago, you're seeing them opt out. So this is not working. But what I will say is that we need to get more creative. This has to be a discussion. Look, Republicans make a lot of mistakes.
Well, if they're opting out, they're going their own way, and they're doing just fine anyway. I mean, these are not mandates.
It absolutely is. I mean, it's a mandate if you want.
Well, it's not a mandate if you opt out of it.
Well, I mean, if you opt out, then you lose the free lunch money. So what I'm saying is, if you want the lunch money that was passed by the Hunger Free Kid Act in 2010, you have to go with these standards, which has ladle size requirements, which has health requirements. I think we can both agree. Let's see where we agree that this is not working. That this needs to be a discussion through a bipartisan.
I have not heard that from any. I'm telling you, I've been doing this radio show for 10 years. I've never had a single person call and say my kid's school lunch sucks.
Well, I mean, you're seeing students say it right now, though. That's, I mean, you have to say that there's validity to these claims. If you go to Twitter and you say lunch movement,
you know, I did.
I would challenge you to
I went over on your website and I looked at all the Twitter feeds, and it looks to me like you got a couple dozen of them.
Well, you can
that's
go
not that's not a movement.
And, no, I mean, I would argue it is. There's many different hashtags being used. Go throughout Twitter, and it's not just lunch movement. You can see kids that are doing a grassroots resistance to this. And it's really because of these new federal standards. There's a reason why a million more kids.
So isn't really what's going on here, Charlie Kirk, that you and TurningPointsUSA.net, that really your agenda is no more federal standards. Let's do away with the federal government to the extent that it's reasonable. It's basically the libertarian agenda. Let's roll back the role of federal government to that of running the courts and the army. And let the billionaires and the big corporations come in and run everything else.
Well, no, I didn't say anything like that. Instead, it's a message of...
Well, that's all over the... I'm looking at your website here, you know?
No, I understand.
The Supreme Court ruled correctly on campaign finance reform, the reality of the winter soldier, the lunch movement.
So there is a lot of opinions on our website, and we encourage open discussion. But the first thing that we focus on is student empowerment. And we start to see thousands of tweets on Twitter, not just using this hashtag, but hashtag all across Twitter. We have to say there's some legitimacy to these claims. Number two, when you're seeing millions of kids and hundreds of school districts drop out of this program, you must think to yourself, this is not the best thing. And if you see these schools, I encourage all your
listeners. But your alternative is to privatize it. How is it that throwing the profit motive into our public schools is somehow going to make them better? I mean, if you look at for-profit schools in America, whether they're high schools or whether they're colleges, they do worse. You know, the for-profit colleges have the highest default rate in the United States, the highest dropout rate in the United States, the highest rate of fraud in the United States. You've got your student debt clock over there on your website at turningpointusa.net. You know, it's your students' share of the national debt, but what about the actual student debt? You got student debt in this country of $1 trillion, largely because Reagan's privatizing our schools.
I'm not saying privatize at all, but let's use another analogy here. Would we have our kids use laptops that they hate, that don't work, that they're throwing away every day? That's exactly what's happening with these school lunches. It's no different than a tool that is used in a classroom environment.
So you're saying that we should do in the school system that we should do whatever our children want?
No, if the
why don't we give everybody a star and give everybody straight A's and lots and lots of Twinkies?
Let me finish my point. What I'm saying is that the school lunch is no different than a tool that's used in a classroom. It's no different than a laptop. It's no different than a projector. It's no different than a mechanism that is used to promote education.
Right.
And if our students are not eating and they are leaving hungrier than they come in the morning, that is a failed program.
I would be astounded to find even one student who leaves school hungrier. Genuine hunger? No.
The Government Accountability Office is showing that schools are dropping out of this program at a record rate. This program is a failed program.
Right. It may or may not be true, so let's fine-tune the program. But, you know, what you're calling for is no program. You're saying, let's turn this over to the corporations and the billionaires.
Let's put a system of checks and balances, which an opt-out has. Admittedly, that's a good.
What's the checks and balances? You've got local school boards. That's your local checks and balances.
Exactly, but the problem with that is they're also tying other federal funding. So these school districts say, yeah, these lunches are really, really terrible, but we're not going to get rid of them because there's other federal funding that's being tied to it. That's wrong.
So we should just do away with all federal funding and block grant the whole damn thing.
No, again, that's another straw man that you're throwing at me. I did not say that at all. I'm saying that this should be a real discussion, that it should be a bipartisan discussion. And you're seeing parents in the downtown Chicago and all across the country, parents that are Democrat, parents that are Republican, parents that are independent, say that this school lunch program is not.
Well, maybe you're seeing it. I'm not seeing it. Like I said, I've never had anybody call this program and complain. I mean, maybe they will after this segment. In fact, we'll open the lines, and we're on the air in Chicago and a very large station. It's got several repeaters. It covers the entire metro area, and we'll see if people call in and say the school lunches really suck. I didn't realize I was going to hit the break.
My
clock in here.
Tom, I listen to your program a lot. I really respect your opinion. I'm honored to be on. I don't agree with you on everything, but I think this is an important discussion to have. And the sooner we can admit this is a failed program, the sooner we can fix it.
Okay. You get the last word. Charlie Kirk, TurningPointUSA.net. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you so much.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, Chicago, do your school lunches suck? We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles.
Give me 1 second.
You are on the air.
First of all, I was calling in about corporate. I guess Republicans and the conservatives asking for more, less taxes on the corporations. And my argument is basically, if we were to do that, then basically the money that the federal government is getting as far as revenue from these corporations, which also help fund all our social services like Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, housing. I mean, they're just basically trying to find a way that, or make a way that these corporations don't have to contribute.
Sure, they're trying to kill off all this stuff. They're trying to take us back to the era of Charles Dickens.
Exactly. So we have to stop. We have to find a way that we have to put our foot down and say enough is enough, because even the Republicans that draw Social Security, their Social Security is also in jeopardy. They may also be one day living in a cardboard box or even a castle, and this is basically it.
Yeah.
As far as that guy that was just on before, I don't believe in anything that he's saying. And still, that goes back to their rhetoric. They don't want to pay for anything. Imagine if there was a federal standard on every kid in this country getting a free lunch and eating healthy food. Basically, that would take all the money away from all of these private enterprises that want to dig into those public school districts. And,
there's like money to be made in the public schools, I'm telling you. Charles, excellent points both. Thank you very much for the call. Peggy, in Bend, Oregon, you wanted to talk about the Bundy Ranch, the BLM, and the horses?
That's right, Tom. Yeah, the Bundy Bash and the range wars.
Mm-hmm.
The caller from Northern California in the last segment said just about everything that I wanted to say. You know, she was saying that the BLM is not the white hats in this situation, that they've been rounding up the Mustangs and the wild horses and the burros for decades, and selling them off and so forth. And I believe one of your arguments was that horses were a late introduction to the West by the Spaniards.
Well, I'm not making an argument. I frankly don't know the answer to this problem. I do know that horses are an invasive species. Yeah, the Indians of North America were pedestrians until the 1600s.
Yeah, well, I think an even later introduction to the West was ranchers and livestock.
Was cattle. Yeah, you're right. That was a century later. Yeah.
And also the BLM and the federal and state governments.
That was an even later introduction. You're right. That was the 1800s.
Right. So the only thing indigenous to the West was what? The Native Americans?
Yeah, the Shoshone and the Paiute in the case of Nevada. So maybe we should just turn it all back over to them.
And the bison, we're going to bring back the bison?
Well, we're doing that, actually. They're bringing back the bison in Yellowstone pretty aggressively and pretty successfully.
Fairly successfully, yeah. But we almost succeeded in wiping out both of them, didn't we?
We did. We did. Just like we wiped out the carrier pigeon. Peggy, do you have a point to make in a sentence or two?
Yeah. Bundy, with his cattle, he sends them out to graze, fattens them, and sends them to slaughter, right?
Right.
BLM rounds up people.
They're doing the same thing with the horses. Okay. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, how sweet. David, in Chicago, listening to WCPT, you have a daughter in the public school who eats the public school lunches? Really?
Yeah.
So, tell me about it.
School lunches. She eats them, I mean, not every day. I mean, we give her a lot, make a lunch once in a while. But
sure.
When I was in school, we had a co-op program where we went out to another school, and we actually baked and helped cook the lunches for them.
Wow.
I'd like to see it expanded, the program, so that the students actually got involved with it. I mean, obviously not, first year or something like that, kindergarten, but like when they hit middle school, I could see, you know, like your second year.
Yeah, or grow a garden in the backyard and, you know, have the kindergartners pulling carrots and stuff. I mean, it's, get them involved with their food. I'm all in favor of that.
Yeah. And it would, you know, they're learning life skills and stuff like that as well.
Yep.
So, I mean, you're adding education and you're providing good, healthy foods of which they can eat.
Yeah.
So, and it works out for everybody.
Yeah. So, but your daughter does not have a complaint with the public school lunches in Chicago?
No, not one.
No.
She actually enjoys it.
Okay.
No problem.
Okay. And I got to tell you, you know, although we don't have a lot of open lines right now, we've got, let's see, one open line out of 12. So, you know, it might not be easy for people to call in, but I don't have. Okay, here's Charles Dinglewood, Colorado. He wants to weigh in on this. David, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to WCPT. Charles, you're not in Chicago. You're in Colorado, but you have an opinion on school lunches?
Yes. I'm definitely in Colorado, but, you know, the school lunch thing, I mean, let's face it, school lunches have been a joke. You know, the mystery meat thing has been a joke for ages, but doesn't mean that you throw the whole program out.
Sure.
A little personal situation, you know, back when I was a kid, I'm much older, but back when I was a kid, we had, my parents had a visit from social services. The school cafeteria ladies were quite concerned about us because we ate the vegetables and we went back for seconds because their seconds were allowed and they thought we weren't getting any food at all.
Well, let me tell you, we raised our kids to be vegetarians. I mean, they literally were vegetarian from birth. And now they're in their 30s, and all three of them, well, two of the three of them are still vegetarians. One of our children, in fact, it was our oldest. When we had moved schools, and I think it was in seventh grade, maybe eighth grade, and she was new to this school. We had moved. And she came in and said, I'm a vegetarian. They didn't have vegetarian lunches in the school. And she wrote an essay about it that she presented to her class. And, I mean, originally they were saying to us, you know, is your daughter getting a proper nutrition? Do we need to call social services? Are you members of some weird religious cult? Because this was back 20 years ago, you know. And then she wrote this essay, and they started providing a vegetarian option in the school. And all these other kids started becoming vegetarians. And so... You know, what can you say?
I agree. I'm not vegetarian, but, you know, we just, you know, we didn't have, you know, candy in the house. And, for us, you know, after school snack was, hey, peel a couple of carrots and sit down in front of the TV and, you know, watch cartoons and eat some carrots.
Yeah.
And the school lunch lady just thought that was amazing because we not only went back for seconds, but we went back for seconds.
You like the vegetables. Okay, Charles, thanks for weighing in. Michael in Chicago, listening to WCPT. You have three kids in the public schools.
Yeah, I definitely do, Tom, and thanks for having me on the program. I wanted to talk a little bit about that public school lunches, and I think that the program is infinitely valuable. A lot of the students in the schools that my two of my kids attend, different schools, a lot of the students are underprivileged, come from, poor or local lower middle class neighborhoods, and that meal that they're getting at school is integral to their ability to function. I think that your previous caller, what prompted me to call, was that I don't think anybody's really saying this program should be eradicated, but it certainly needs to be modified when 3 days out of the week, students are being fed what's literally a frozen pizza reheated in an oven, and that's a balanced meal.
And that's happening in your public school in Chicago?
That's happening in public schools across the nation.
Well,
4 years ago when the FDA made, you know, a pizza a vegetable.
Oh, you're talking about when the Reagan administration said that the ketchup was a vegetable?
4 years ago, the FDA.
No, it was Ronald Reagan who did it.
No, this was specifically pizza. I don't want to argue the point.
Oh, okay.
I'm
thinking tomato sauce on a pizza, you know.
Yeah, indeed. And sure, there's grains, there's vegetables, but when that's what's being served by these small to medium-sized corporations that have a hold on food service in the institution of the public school systems, they are minimizing costs just like every other corporation, which means that our children are receiving minimal nutrition to barely meet the guidelines. And
small to medium-sized corporations? If you don't mind, Michael, give me the name of the public school that you're talking about here, and let me just do a little homework.
Districts are Illinois School District 15 and School District 87 are two that my two of my kids attend.
They don't have names. They're just 15 and 87.
Well, they compromise five or six schools each.
Can you give me the name of one school serves pizza 3 days a week?
In Illinois.
What's the school?
Mark Wharton Middle School in Illinois.
Mark Wharton? In
Bloomingdale, Illinois.
Mark.
Marquardt.
Say it again. I'm sorry.
Glenbard East High School School District is another one.
Okay. Glenbard. B-A-R-T, I assume.
B-A-R-D.
D. Okay. Glenbard East. Okay. Let me do a little homework. Michael, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you.
Absolutely. Have a great day, Tom.
Yeah, thank you. Patricia in Sacramento. Oh, are we out of time? Yeah, I've got a half a minute. Patricia, a quick one?
Yeah, real quick. Yeah, my kids are in the San Juan School District here in Sacramento. They won't eat the food lunch. But my solution is definitely not to privatize it, is to do what Jamie Oliver was trying to do, is to get the people in the cafeteria to start cooking local fresh foods.
Right.
And right now it's already corporatized. We buy all our food from big corporations, which is just frozen garbage.
Right.
Basically.
There you go. Patricia, get the local food co-ops involved, for example. Patricia, thank you very much. In fact, I would say if you want to privatize it, do so with the stipulation that it has to be a local co-op. It's got to be locally owned, and it's got to be cooperatively owned. And I'll bet that would change things a lot. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And who are these corporations who are feeding our kids now? I got to track this one down. We'll be back. Good, the bad, and the very, very chock-a-blockly ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good, Pablo Ruiz, the Spanish judge, is doing what no judge in the United States is doing, taking action to try to prosecute the Bush administration for its war crimes. In decision issued on Tuesday, Ruiz says he will not drop his investigation into torture at Guantanamo Bay. Spain's new conservative government recently passed a series of judicial reforms that prevent judges from opening investigations into crimes under so-called universal jurisdiction, investigations into crimes that occur anywhere in the world. Judge Ruiz, however, is sticking to his guns and refusing to cooperate. He thinks that Spain has an obligation to investigate the Bush administration's crimes. I couldn't agree more. I wish more lawmakers here in the U.S. thought they had such an obligation. The bad. Wilshire Gunn, the owner of this Oklahoma City gun shop, which is still under construction, thinks he has a great idea to give his store that extra flair that all successful businesses have, an on-site bar. Seriously, no joke. Check it out.
Cruz worked to finish a state-of-the-art indoor gun range to make history in Oklahoma. At 40,000 square feet, co-owner Jeff Swanson says it will be a full-fledged destination.
As a group, we wanted to build a place, the first one in Oklahoma, where you could come in, shoot, enjoy the retail area, and then go to the cafe.
It's the cafe that's raising some eyebrows. Owners want to serve food and alcohol.
I've not seen a business that, you know, that does the firearms, that has a liquor license, but, you know, it's possible that if they apply, you know, they could be the first one.
Guns and booze. What could possibly go wrong? And the very, very ugly, Phyllis Schlafly. During a recent editorial for the Christian Post, the anti-feminist crusader argued that the gender pay gap is the result of men not being attracted to high-earning women. She said while women prefer to have a high-earning partner, men generally prefer to be the higher-earning partner in a relationship. This simple but profound difference between the sexes has powerful consequences for the so-called pay gap. Suppose the pay gap between men and women were magically eliminated. If that happened, simple arithmetic suggests that half of women would be unable to find what they regard as a suitable mate. Look, there are things that Phyllis Schlafly and I actually agree about, power of the Supreme Court being one of them. But the idea that men don't like high-earning women just promotes the worst kind of ideas about what it means to be a woman and a man. And that is very, very ugly. Amazing. Okay. Jim in Maywood, Illinois. Hey, Jim, thanks for listening to WCPT. You wanted to talk about Michelle Obama's food program?
Yeah, Tom. We come here as a blank page. Our parents tell us what to eat and what not to eat. You did a very good job with raising your children. I don't know why other parents can't do likewise. I went to the Chicago Public Schools, and in the day that I went, kids ate lunch in school whose parents worked, and some of them had no lunch because they had very little money in the house.
Right.
So the school programs have been beneficial, but the best thing was for Michelle to get out here and tell people what was good for their health and what wasn't. And people don't like it, but maybe they like McDonald's with its fast food.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've taught their kids that.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jim. We set examples for our children, and you know, and Michelle Obama, I think, is setting a great example for all of America. Robert in Bensenville, Illinois, also listening to WCPT. Oh, you got a bunch of Chicago callers now. Hey, this is cool. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom? You guys have a bunch of callers, and you guys are doing a great job.
Thank you.
No problem. I just wanted to say, I think, you know, with your the one caller that was talking about the food hashtag movement, I think you have an idea that just wasn't thought all the way through. And George Carlin said it best, you know, you have the fictional thought that you have a choice, you know, between Coke or Pepsi, you know, Domino's or McDonald's.
Right.
And when I went to school, it was privatized food lunches, like McDonald's on Monday, Domino's on Wednesday, and something else on Friday. And the kids that didn't have money got free lunches and were looked down upon, or maybe in their own minds looked down upon and degraded, because we all were growing up in the early 90s and going through, well, growing up in one of the worst times for a generation to grow up. And now, you know, we're just fed up. There's a lot of us that are non-bipartisan and don't want to do either one party. We just want the right way.
You would like the working class to be able to be the middle class once again? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, where you were able to stay with the job, you know, do your job well, putting your time, and you would get promoted in ample time.
Yeah, and one person can make a decent living and raise a family and have a home and take a vacation and buy a car every couple of years. And yeah, I'm with you, Robert. You want to do that, you're going to have to roll back Reaganomics. The Reagan Revolution, you know, put an end to all that. But, you know, good point. And we agree on that. Even if you're right or left, I suppose it doesn't matter. Angie in St. John, Indiana, listening on WCPT. You don't like the public school. By the way, I'm looking at the Chicago Tribune. There's an article here by Monica Ng. It's from a couple of years ago, but she, in this article, she says that the principal supplier of the food to the CPS, the Chicago Public School System, is a company called, where'd it go again? I had it here just a second ago. Anyhow, tell me what you were going to say, Mon. Oh, here it is, Chartwell's Thompson, which I don't know anything about. So back to you, Angie.
Okay, I'm out in Northwest Indiana, and lunches aren't that good. They do serve chicken nuggets at least once a week. They do serve pizza at least once a week.
Yeah.
And the quality of the food isn't that good. And you ask why people aren't saying anything, it's because parents aren't coming to the schools for lunchtime.
Right.
They're not seeing the quality of the food.
What do you think should be done about that, Angie?
I don't know. I know we do need a public or a lunch program, but we do need to raise the quality of the food.
Yeah.
When I grew up, they actually cooked the meals.
Mm-hmm.
They're not cooking the meals.
Yeah.
They are just heating them up.
Yeah, I remember the school lunch lady and they were pulling a lot of stuff out of cans, but they were also making a lot of fresh stuff, particularly during the summer.
Right.
And in the fall.
And the foods aren't fresh now. They are doing a better job about getting fresh fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
But the main dish, the quality has gone down dramatically.
Interesting. Okay, Angie, thank you. Thanks for weighing in. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama, you wanted to get back to the Bureau of Land Management.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
A lot of people don't know it, but the Bureau of Land Management has been rounding up the horses for many years.
Yeah.
And they take the young ones and put them in an adoption program. We have a lot of them here in Alabama.
Hmm.
The very young ones make good riding horses.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority of them are rounded up and sent to the new slaughter factory in the Southwest that was designed for specifically slaughtering horses.
Right.
And this provides horse meat for Europe.
Yep. That's what I thought. I was quite sure I'd heard that, or that maybe it was Madeline Pickens told me about it, or I read it, whatever. But yeah.
Yeah. And,
so what's a better solution? I mean, if it's like when I grew up in Michigan, and when Louise and I lived in Vermont, everybody went hunting in the fall for deer. And
yeah.
The whole rationale was that, and in fact, it is a big problem in Michigan. It wasn't so much of a problem in Vermont. I never saw a deer on the road. But in Michigan, every fall, I mean, during mating season and whatnot, you can't drive 60 miles in Michigan without seeing a dead deer by the side of the road. And
you better not drive 30 a night down here in the winter during breeding season, or you'll hit a deer.
Yeah, same thing. So the rationale for hunting season was to thin the herd, because the deer don't, they're natural predators. The wolves and mountain lions have been displaced by humans. And so humans have to become the predators. So, what's the solution with the horses? I mean, how are the horses different from the deer? And what's the best way if we're not going to be their natural predators by rounding them up and turning them into hamburger and selling it to Poland, then what do we do?
I don't know. It used to be easy and cheap to keep a horse. Now it's an expensive endeavor, and
yeah.
It requires a great deal of money to maintain.
Oh, I know all about
horse.
That. Our oldest daughter had a horse for about 6 years when she was growing up, and boy.
I had 12.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. You have 12 horses?
Yes, I bred warm bloods.
Wow.
But it's just now it is very expensive, particularly when you have a drought and there's hay. One year we ordered hay out of Ohio, and that was expensive. But the horses, they've been out there since, the first Pony Express rider.
Yeah.
And then we switched to trains. But the thing is that these people who want to use these federal lands, if they establish a precedent of where they have had the right to use it, they can eventually claim this land as their own.
No, they can't.
Well, they're going to try.
They are trying. But then, you also get the problem of if the BLM is, if part of their mandate is to regulate the horses, we got to figure out what do you do with that. But part of it is to manage the land. I mean, the horses are messing with the land. The cattle are messing with the land.
Well, we need a catch and release like we do with stray cats.
You mean just gelding, or whatever the word is, castrate them all?
Gelding, yes.
Yeah.
But they're also being used with the prison programs in helping young men learn how to handle themselves and control their temper and learn patience so that they can be returned to society as productive people.
Yeah, I have a friend in Australia, Jeff Guest, who's been doing that for years and years, way out in the outback in Thetford. But I'm not familiar personally with any programs in the United States, but I've heard of them. Norma, thanks for opening an interesting topic of conversation. I appreciate you talking.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, school lunches, horses, and then, of course, the Bundy Ranch. What's Sean Hannity up to? And, of course, Reaganomics. I mean, there's always Reaganomics. Bruce, in Atlanta, Georgia, on Free Speech TV, watching on the Dish satellite system, you wanted to correct me that horses are not an invasive species in North America?
Yes, Dr. Hartman. Good afternoon. As always, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Well, from what I understand from paying attention to these sort of things, ancient life forms or what have you, the horse actually evolved in North America.
Right.
And it's technically a reintroduced species by the Spanish and not an invasive species.
Okay.
And they survived into Central Asia long enough for someone to decide that it was a good idea to domesticate them, and they found their way back here eventually.
Right. It was the first Native Americans. It was the first immigrants across the land bridge from Asia or whatever. I mean, that 20,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago wiped out the wild horses.
That seems to be the general consensus. There's some debate, of course, amongst the brainiacs who study this. But yes.
Right.
So they were technically not an invasive species. They were here originally.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Point made. And I can't disagree with that.
I just wanted to pass that on. Always a good show. Enjoy what you do and keep doing it, Dr.
Thank you,
Harmon.
Bruce. Thank you. Thank you very much. Clayton in Butler, Missouri. Hey, Clayton.
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
The BLM was set up to get rid of the sheep ranchers.
Oh, really?
The cattle on the Bundy ranch is worth $1,350,000, or worth $1,500 a head. And you can go to the USDA website and see what fat cattle's worth.
Right.
I mean, it's a government program. I mean, fat cattle today are trading at $1.45 today on a 1,250-pound steer.
Interesting.
But they cut a deal in the back room. I mean, Ross Perot told the American people about the deal that was cut. Bush Sr. cut a deal in the back room with Cargill and a bunch of those guys that they'd get rid of all the sheep ranchers out of there because it cost $7.50 a head to run a sheep on that ground. It cost $5 to run a cow. And he made a promise to all the ranchers that they could expand their herd if they would just get rid of the sheep program, which they did, because they used to subsidize wool. They no longer subsidize wool. Get rid of the Native American and the Basque.
Whoa.
And then, once they got rid of them, then they started working on the ranchers, and now Cargill, Monsanto, all those run the cattle on the BLM land, not ranchers.
Yeah, well, I saw yesterday, in fact, I've got it right in front of me here. This is from Koch Industries, that Koch Industries runs three giant, we're talking hundreds of thousands of acres, three giant ranches, Beaverhead near Yellowstone in Montana, Spring Creek in Flint Hills, Kansas, and the Matador Ranch in Texas. Everybody's getting in on the act here, it seems.
Right. Tyson's Farm is owned by a corporation out of Japan and China. They're the largest conglomerate of agriculture owned in the country.
Yeah, Tyson got bought out by the Japanese. Cause, I mean, that started as a local company in the South, in Georgia, wasn't it?
Right. There was two brothers and a sister.
Yeah.
But they got bought out. The whole operation. It's the same as the horse. They all got sent to Mexico. There's not one horse killed in the United States. It all got sent to Mexico.
I see. Okay, Clayton, thank you for the information. That's particularly interesting. The Bundy herd is worth $1.3 million. Fascinating. Anyhow, we'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the end. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give the gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan. Ellen Ratner on the line with us. Ellen, were you around this weekend, by the way? Louise and I almost called you up to say hi, and then I figured you were probably out of town. Ellen? Ellen's on the line and doesn't realize she's on the line.
Ah, something happened.
Uh-huh.
There I am.
Okay.
I wasn't around last weekend and won't be around this weekend, but after this I will be around.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah, this weekend I won't be around either, but we should get together.
What do I have to tell you?
Okay.
You are such an expert at Ukraine, and you know so much, and it is amazing to watch all of this military and NATO stuff, and no one tells the other sides of the stories. It's really quite amazing.
This seems to me like it could become, if we play it wrong, a World War One scenario. I'm very concerned.
Well, we are moving towards playing it wrong in a big way today. NATO, off the record, sort of on background, talked about an increase in military patrols on NATO's eastern border. They talked about defense. And
you mean on the eastern border of Ukraine?
Right, that's correct.
Whoa.
That's right. Basically, the NATO countries that are near there,
right.
They talked about defense and de-escalation and deterrence, but de-escalation, well, they're escalating. They're also sending aircraft and ships. The word is deterrence, but as you know, it's not deterrence. The good news, the only good news, is that President Putin talked to Chancellor Merkel today, or maybe it was yesterday, but it was in the last 24 hours, I don't know what they talked about, but as you know, a lot of the natural gas that Germany uses and Europe does come from Russia, so they have to be careful, fortunately.
Yeah, well, and in fact, that's where I'm going to be this weekend. I'm going to be in Germany, so I'm going to learn everything I can about the perspective that they have over there and bring
that
back.
Well, that would be amazing. That would be amazing, and of course, you usually always have it. By the way, Chairman Royce, Republican from California, of a committee, and Elliot Engel from New York, the ranking member, are going to go to Ukraine this week, and they are going to voice support for Ukraine.
Good.
Okay. Now, guess what? Former Mayor Bloomberg, owner of Bloomberg News, says that he is going to go to heaven. He's not going to stop to be interviewed on his way. And it is because he says he is going to give $50 million to go to the NRA to against the NRA, not to the NRA, to fight the NRA's insistence on guns.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Now, this is what's really interesting. Bush, number two, appointed a federal judge. And his name is Dr. Judge Hevland, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. He is a Bush appointee. He is in Bismarck, North Dakota, and he overturned a law in North Dakota banning most abortion, or pretty much all abortion, if any kind of fetal heartbeat is detected. He said that was unconstitutional.
Interesting. So this is not the first time that one of these anti-abortion bills that slip in under the Roe v. Wade benchmarks of basically viability. I mean, heartbeat happens long before brain development, for example, complex brain development and other things. It's fairly early on in the process.
That's correct. And what's very interesting, I mean, to me, the most interesting thing is not just that the Bush, that this bill slipped through. It's that it was a Bush appointee overturned it.
Right, right.
So when you have that, good luck to some of these characters.
Yeah.
Okay. A couple of other interesting things. United Nations Committee on Relations with the host country. There's actually a United Nations Committee on that. They are going to look at the legal response to the United States refusing the Iranian appointee to be ambassador, a guy whose name is Hamad, and don't ask me to pronounce the last name because I will mess it up, but they are going to be taking that up next week.
Okay.
A couple other interesting things, income tax refunds. As you know, Washington Post did an article today, I believe, about Social Security overpayments being asked to be paid for by the next generation, and we consider things that go on in North Korea where they put three generations in jail bad. Well, of course, this isn't as bad, but it is interesting. Charles Grassley, the senator, is sending letters, and my guess is they're going to probably be hearings in the House.
Oh, the IRS quit doing it, though, yesterday or the day before.
They did quit doing it. They did quit doing it, but they want to know why they did it to begin with.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough. And also, even though...
I agree. I mean, shouldn't the statute of limitations end when you die?
I agree. I mean, that is correct. A stop clock is right twice a day, and Republicans are occasionally right. They are right on this one.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's just Republicans. But
they're the ones that made the moaning and groaning about it, and they happen to be correct on this one.
So
once a blue moon or a red moon, right? They're correct. It's a red moon. Okay, a guy by the name of Liam Fox, he was a British detective type. He was at the American Enterprise today, and he called Edward Snowden anti-Western, perverse anti-Western, and he said that the people that were in favor of Snowden are incompetence added to arrogance.
So is he in favor of a national surveillance state that is not accountable to the people?
Well, of course, he wasn't saying, and he's British, so he can get away with anything, but you could darn well best if the American Enterprise was hosting this, Tom.
It's all about privatization of intelligence.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I happen to be in the great state of Ohio, which is my home state, and I just want to say that us doing a lot of this manufacturing in other countries like China, et cetera, has completely decimated what I know as the Midwest of Ohio.
Oh, yeah.
And it is really time for infrastructure improvements, which desperately need to be needed. And I just don't understand why we are not moving ahead with it and why people are not...
We need to change our trade policies, Ellen. You know, Ross Perot is right, and we need to just admit it. Anyhow, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Been all over the map here in our conversation today, from Sean Hannity trying to whip up who knows what he's trying to do, but you know, asking this young man if the feds come in there, how are you going to defend your father if they try to kill him? It's like, or I'm paraphrasing, to school lunches, to what's going on with the cattle, to what's going on with this whole, you know, Bundy Ranch. You know, millionaire ranchers and billionaire Americans for Prosperity versus who? And repeatedly throughout this, I keep pointing out, you know, if this is, there's a whole lot of bread and circus going on here, because the middle class, ever since, you know, the Reaganomics went large, the middle class of America is increasingly no longer working class people. Working class people are becoming the working poor. And, you know, the middle class is basically just becoming the professional class. This is the essence of this new book that's out by Thomas Piketty, this French economist. And it's now available in English. And, you know, you have to decide to have a middle class. If you want to have a middle class, capitalism doesn't produce it. Capitalism produces a small professional and mercantile middle class, but it produces a large class of the working poor. And if you want to have a middle class, you have to do it through policies, through government intervention, frankly. And Seattle is doing that. And Shamish Sawant is on the line with us, a member of the Seattle City Council, a leader in the 15 Now campaign, member representing the Socialist Party, and seattle.gov/council/Sawant, S-A-W-A-N-T, on the line with us. Welcome back, Councilwoman.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us what's going on in Seattle.
In Seattle, we are having one of the first real democratic debates that we've had in the nation in so many decades. As you were correctly pointing out, Tom, that we have the ranks of the working poor expanding dramatically at the same time that the profits of the S&P 500 corporations are at historic levels. CEO salary is at an average of $7,000 per hour. And we're seeing a more and more polarized debate in Seattle where, you know, workers and social justice activists have come out strongly in support of a $15 measure. But what they're asking for, what they're demanding, is a strong $15 measure that does not look like a Swiss cheese 15, you know, with one carve out after another. We have over 100,000 workers in Seattle who make less than 15. Given the cost of living in Seattle, even 15 is not enough. And the discussion has gained so much momentum because of the grassroots campaigns in SeaTac last year because of fast food workers all around the nation, because of our grassroots campaign for city council last year, and the city government has been forced to put this at the top of the political agenda. And we have to make sure that the grassroots movement keeps ramping up, because this is the reason why we got here. And we have, at this stage, we have the mayor who said that he will be sending a recommendation to the city council next week, and then after that, the city council will start deliberating. But, you know, let's step back and look at how democratic the process is and how democratic it could actually be. We have 9 city council members who are going to decide the fates of 100,000 workers. And I think if those workers want to have their voices heard, we have to keep building 15 now to make sure that we get a strong $15 ordinance from the city council.
What happened, you know, SeaTac, a suburb of Seattle, was the first to vote this in, were they not? What's the status of that right now?
They won because, you know, through a ballot initiative, first of all, and they won because labor activists, the labor movement, and low-wage workers themselves went out in support of $15 an hour. They knocked on doors. They ran a genuine grassroots campaign, and they won the $15 measure. And I wanted to share an interesting story. There were several businesses who spoke out against $15 an hour, the same, you know, garden variety fear mongering that goes on every time we fight for a progressive measure was happening there. We had businesses proclaiming apocalyptic scenarios of how the economy would collapse, there would be massive joblessness, homelessness. None of that has happened. As a matter of fact, Master Park, one of the companies that was speaking out against $15 an hour, and I believe they spend several thousands of dollars in the campaign against the SeaTac measure. They recently put up a banner outside their business saying something like, you know, jobs available, $15 an hour. So in reality, they are expanding, and that basically encapsulates the story of the fear-mongering versus the reality.
Right, right. Recently, a member of Congress, yesterday, I think it was, came out and said that this, you know, this whole thing is wrong. But the reality is that over time, actually, I want to ask you a different question. When FDR got Social Security pushed through, and we saw the exact same thing happen with minimum wage laws, and in fact, it's still a case with minimum wage laws across the country. Basically, the deal that he cut with the Southern racists, the Southern white racists, was we will pass the Social Security program and we will largely exclude African Americans from it by excluding domestic labor and farm labor. African Americans and at that time that was an awful lot of farm labor. Now that would be Hispanics as well. And that was enough to get the white racists on board for Social Security. Similarly, our minimum wage laws are filled with Swiss cheese, like you said, that include things like farm labor and restaurant labor, which is predominantly female. To what extent do you think the average person in Seattle gets it that not only is there a problem with minimum wage, but there's a problem with the way that these laws are constructed that is inherently both racist and sexist?
I think that people on the ground, you know, people who are living the grim realities of poverty wages, they understand the fundamental nature of that capitalist economy. They may not use the words you and I use, but they understand that the economy is not working for them. They get that they are breaking their backs every day and yet not making enough to pay their rent. You know, if you look at some of the lower rent housing in Seattle, it is so horrible. I mean, any person would cringe at having to have any human being live in these situations, let alone somebody who's working hard to make the city run. I think what's missing or what's been missing in this narrative of the decline of the working class and the race to the bottom in so many decades is the latent power of workers, the confidence that workers can have to fight back against the Southern racist businesses, as you talked about. And also, you know, this is happening today. You talked about tipped workers. I think that's an important point to raise. Why did we arrive at a point where we did end up getting a federal minimum wage and we did get state minimum wages? These are all steps in the right direction, but we only got it because the National Restaurant Association was willing to stop lobbying against it on the condition that tipped workers be left out of the minimum wage. Right. So in 43 states in this country, tipped workers are at a sub-minimum wage, in some cases as low as $2.13. If that is not stomach-turning to anybody, I don't know what will be. And I think that's happening because the real ability, the real power of the working class to fight against big business money is far from being tapped. And that's what, if there is anything different that's happening in Seattle, that's what's starting to unfold. You know,
there you go.
Working people are starting to understand that we can actually fight against this fear mongering. We can organize. We may not have the tens of millions of dollars that business is, assuredly going to pour.
Hold on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman
sorry,
Program.
Sorry, step down. Shama Swan, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but thank you so much. I'm totally with you. You're doing great work. Thank you so much
thank
for being
so
with
much.
Us. Bye. And welcome back. Dave, watching Free Speech TV in Ferndale, Michigan. Hey, Dave, you wanted to talk about wild horses?
Yeah, it's actually Ferndale, Washington. And in just briefly with regards to your last person, I live in the hinterlands of Seattle, and we do understand what's going on here.
Uh-huh.
Basically, I wanted to, there's so many more subjects that are so much more important, but this is on a personal level, correct some of the misunderstandings and misinformation you've been provided. The horses were indigenous to North America. They disappeared about 10,000, 15,000 years ago, along with the giant sloth and a couple other things, about the time that human beings came across the land bridge. And
right, the speculation is that
America.
We ate them all.
Yes, but they were definitely
Clovis people
to America, so we're just reestablishing what was already there. I would also point out that a woman by the name of Velma Johnson, who was known as Wild Horse Annie, was chiefly responsible for the legislation that was introduced in our country to protect the wild horses. It was intended to, but it's been ignored and distorted and changed over the years. And she was from Nevada. She fought a great fight there. The people in Nevada, the ranchers and the oil frackers, all those people have been trying to get rid of the horses, the indigenous horses in Nevada for decades. It's nothing new. And it's just continuing from where it originally started. BLM was commissioned to protect them, and they failed that dismally in so many ways.
Well, wait a minute. Wait, was the BLM commissioned to protect the horses, or was the BLM
yes.
commissioned to administer and protect federal lands? And
they were specifically commissioned to protect the wild horses by two different acts that Velma Johnson was responsible for getting introduced.
Okay.
They were also
so what do you do? What do you
land.
Do with like earlier?
Veterinary associations have volunteered to go in and freely neuter. And spay horses to keep the population in control. The BLM used to run a rigorous and very popular adoption program. They adopted 10,000 horses a year out. They stopped doing that. That was one of the chief controls of the population.
Well, one of the things, that was costed money, and B, which, you know, the Republicans keep cutting these budgets, and then B...
it takes money. That's wrong. The program was making money.
Okay.
A lottery to a bid, and because there's several
so why they stop doing it?
Herds, I don't know why. They just recently, I have adopted horses on my property right now.
Huh.
I've been to at least a dozen adoptions, and it's not just young horses, it's all horses, all ages.
Right.
And there were some things I observed that weren't quite above board. I once saw a bucking outfit from a rodeo take four stallions, but they were older and on the edge of being impossible, and then they received cadillac treatment. They're not poorly treated by any sense, and that was the exception and not necessarily the rule. And I'm a little rattled because the Bundy people, those guys, and including the corporate ranches, illegally shooting wild horses, continue to do it on an ongoing basis in every state, and there's about seven states that have feral horses. And what Velma Johnson was against was, strongly against, was the airplane helicopter rounding up of the horses. It's they couldn't do what they do if they didn't do that. Yeah, the optics of that are pretty bad.
Dave, thanks for the information. I appreciate it. We'll be back in just a moment with Michael Lightly. Stick around. Welcome back, Tom Hartman with you, and 20 minutes past the hour here on the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman program. And with me now is Michael Lightly, right here in the studio, Director of Public Policy at California Nurses Association, National Nurses United. And you guys are hooking up with Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, where, by the way, people can sign the petition to tell Bernie Sanders to run as a Democrat. Do that. Michael, you guys just had a roundtable here in D.C. Do I have that right?
Yes, we did, Tom.
And so tell me about it. And this was a PDA roundtable, National Nurses, all of the above. What?
I was Progressive Democrats of America roundtable.
Mm-hmm.
I was subbing for Tim Carpenter as the moderator. Of course, National Nurses United works closely with PDA. Yeah. And we did a roundtable on the Better Off budget. Gabriela Lemus was there from Progressive Congress,
mm-hmm.
and also other folks who spoke on different aspects of the budget, defense in particular, carbon tax, comparing it to the Obama budget and the Ryan budget.
Now, for people who don't know what we're talking about, the Better Off budget is the budget that was put together by the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives, by the Democrats in the Democratic Progressive Caucus. And it balances the budget in, a decade or two?
Yeah, a decade. That's right.
And you know, which everybody else's budget does.
Right.
And it reorients basically our priorities. It reduces defense somewhat, and it strengthens the social safety net. And what else?
Well, it actually creates 8.8 million jobs, Tom. It uses a financial transaction tax, and we talked about the Robin Hood tax in that context.
Right. This is the old STET tax on stock transactions.
That's right.
It's going to put the high-frequency traders out of business.
Well, exactly, and it's a sales tax. Wall Street traders don't pay sales tax. Most of the rest of us do. That's included in the Better Off budget. It also funds infrastructure, uses a carbon tax to raise revenue, and also funds new programs in education, state aid, which has been decimated, of course, during the Great Recession, and funds those essential human services that have been neglected and combats austerity. And if you want to have an opposite of the Ryan budget, which cuts programs that benefit working people and the poor and raises taxes on the middle class, lowers taxes on the wealthy, the Better Off budget is the polar opposite. And it's a great statement of progressive values. 89 votes in the House.
89 votes.
Yeah.
What is it going to take to get 220?
Well, it's going to take a lot more grassroots effort, like what Progressive Democrats of America does in terms of the letter drops and educating Congress and mobilizing. We're going to have to build a mass movement if we want to reorient the priorities of this country. The president spends more on defense than the sequester limit. Ryan spends, I think, about three times as much above the sequester limit than does the president. And so if we're going to move spending away from defense and the dark side and the hidden, you know, costs of the continuing wars that we're fighting, we're going to have to build a mass movement to do so.
Right. And how do we do that?
Well, we do it by engaging with our folks in our communities. We engage it by doing letter drops and telling our members of Congress what our priorities are. We do it by going to places like nationalpriorities.org, the National Priorities Project, and compare the budgets, compare that to public opinion, write letters to the editor, and then join in demonstrations on these issues and make sure that if people, particularly Republicans, since it's their budget, vote for it, they pay a price in November.
Right. Because public opinion is being largely ignored.
That's right.
What is being attended to, and in fact, the better budget really basically just is, you know, corresponding with public opinion on these issues. It's just, I thought I had it. I don't. But it's you go through the list. I mean, you know,
that's right.
The vast majority of Americans want to strengthen Social Security. They want to strengthen the social safety net. They want something done about the environment. They, you know, long-term unemployment. They want jobs created. So for Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, can people start local chapters in their homes, in their communities?
Absolutely.
How?
Well, they can go to the website and they can find information about how to start a chapter. They can get contact information for PDA staff who can help them do so, because there's staff all around the country that can help them do so. And they can find the resources at PDA America to get the information they need to convince others to join them.
And this is completely independent of the Democratic Party.
It's completely independent of the Democratic Party. I think it's fair to say that the Democratic Party is not a progressive party. There are progressives within it. And it's our job to work outside the party to make the inside better.
Right.
And that really is what, of course, PDA brings to it, the inside outside. I think you're absolutely right, Tom, on the key priorities, and the nationalpriorities.org has that comparison. It literally goes through the provisions of the budget and says where public opinion is and compares that to the budgets. And you're right, better off budgets funds, restores the food stamp cuts, for example, funds unemployment and long-term unemployment insurance, funds the infrastructure people want. So it's and lowers doesn't lower taxes, I should say, on the wealthy.
Right, but it does lower taxes on working people.
But it does.
And job creation, 74% of Americans, Medicaid, 74% of Americans, SNAP, food stamps, 70%, education, 69%, tax loopholes closing them, 67%, corporate taxes, 66% to 79%. These individual taxes, you know, raising taxes on rich people, cutting taxes on the working poor, 61% of people support this. Social Security, 66%. These are the priorities of America, and these are all reflected. Every single one of them, and there's two more pages of this, Medicare or Medicaid, funding war overseas. 82% of Americans want us to cut that.
That's right.
And this budget does. Cutting Pentagon spending, 58% of Americans want to cut that. This budget cuts that. The Ryan budget doesn't. The president's budget doesn't. Discretionary education spending. I mean, it's pretty straightforward stuff.
It is. What's amazing, of course, and not so amazing really if you follow politics, is the clout that lobbyists, special interest, donors have on
thanks
Congress.
Thanks to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and this is, but that's really the difference.
So, Michael Lightly, in the half a minute we have left, what's up with National Nurses United?
We're fighting for Main Street and taxing Wall Street to heal America with the Robin Hood tax, H.R. 1579. We're working to make sure that patients get guaranteed health care as a human right and to win single-payer health care reform, particularly Bernie Sanders' bill, S-1782, that would establish a national single-payer system administered by the states.
That's great. And the website is?
The NationalNursesUnited.org or RobinHoodTax.org.
RobinHoodTax.org, too. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Michael Lightly with the National Nurses United, Director of Public Policy, and today sitting in for Tim Carpenter with Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
It's great to see you again.
Likewise.
We will be right back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And don't forget, RobinHoodTax.org and, of course, PDAmerica.org. Check it out. Amazing. Oklahoma. You know, first they pass a law, if I have this right, banning increases in the minimum wage. Now they passed a law saying that if you generate your own electricity on your roof, you have to pay a special fee to the state. It didn't specify what the fee was. Apparently this was a rider to a piece of legislation that was passed overwhelmingly, like 82-5 or something. You know, it's a very, very popular bill. And people didn't even know it was there. And so this is how you see the fossil fuel industry and these, you know, these shadowy groups in the background, these oil billionaires. They get this stuff in there, you know, to stick it to the solar industry. It's like trying to stop progress. And it's amazing. Harry Ashburn, by the way, corrected me. I said that the Native Americans were pedestrians before the Spaniards brought horses over to North America. He says, no, Tom. The Indians rode segways, right? Boom, boom. Okay. Portrait Fiasco notes there's only 150 signatures needed over at PDAmerica.org to encourage Bernie Sanders to run for president as a Democrat. So 150 more people, get over to PDAmerica.org and sign up. That should be a good one. We've covered a lot of territory in the last couple, you know, 2.5 hours here. We've talked about the school lunch program. We had a conservative on who's saying privatize the whole damn thing. Right. You know, but also I said, are people in Chicago unhappy with their school lunches? What do we do about that? We've been talking about, you know, this welfare rancher out in California or out in Nevada and how Sean Hannity's just trying to whip this up. Do you have that Hannity clip? Play this. This is Sean Hannity last night questioning the rancher and his son. Basically, in my opinion, now I could be wrong, but, you know, one talk show host to another, trying to get the guy to say, yeah, I'll pull out a gun and shoot a federal officer or something, words to that effect. To the credit of the Bundy family, they were unwilling to respond to Hannity's questions in the spirit in which they were asked, shall we say. Here are the questions.
God forbid. I mean, we saw the raid, for example, back with Ellie and Gonzalez. I'm not sure if you remember that raid. What would happen if they came in the early morning hours one day to your ranch? Well, he also said, Richard Mack, is I don't think it would be possible to launch a raid without violence. If they came to arrest you, would you surrender? The sheriff speaking, Harry Reid speaking, and you hear all this. What are your plans? I would assume, as Cliven's son, you want to protect your dad. What are your plans if, in fact, they come late in the night? Do you worry that, in fact, they may kill either your dad or somebody in your family?
I mean, that's pushing the edge of the envelope. Anyhow, John in Chicago, you wanted to get back to the school lunch program there?
Yeah, I did. How are you?
Hey, I'm fine.
I have a very good friend who's been teaching 8 years here in Ford Heights. It's the second poorest school district, but really representative of Chicago, I believe, in this sense. She said, and she's a vegan or close to it, and so am I, that the food has really improved this year, but it's all being, not all, much of it is being thrown out. The students aren't eating it. But that's not surprising if you've grown up on Cheetos and McNuggets, and this is what you've been eating practically your whole life. If you're lower middle class, and that's what Chicago's full of.
Yeah, these kids have developed an addiction to the unholy trinity, which is sugar, salt, and fat.
Yeah, and it doesn't go away in 3 months or 6 months or a year.
Right.
And so we are talking about opening an organic garden or creating one in her school district. We're trying to get it up and running so the kids can see and, you know, and hopefully someone would maybe think about cooking food in the school rather than having things brought in. All of that's in the future, but I would suggest to you, Tom, that that fellow may have had a small point, but he was misinterpreting it purposefully.
Right. Or he was using it to rationalize privatizing school lunches. I mean, that was the answer that he proposed. John, thank you for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Carol in Orange, California, you wanted to get back to the cattle and sheep on federal lands. And the fellow who called earlier and said that all the sheep have been run off the federal lands, that the range wars were the cattle versus sheep wars. What's your take on all this?
Well, what it comes down to, yeah, most of the sheep have been run off by the cattle interest. Sheep can be somewhat more destructive of pasture lands, but the real problem is that cattle, like you were talking about earlier about indigenous animals, the American buffalo, when it roamed the plains, because of the structure of their hoof, they would turn the soil and in doing that, generate more grasses over.
Right,
and
they
over
have
again.
smaller feet that put a lot of weight. They dig in deeper, basically, and they pull the soil around. Whereas cattle have wide feet that don't turn the soil. In fact, they compact it. Do I have that right?
Right. And so these grasses and natural plants aren't able to regenerate, and you end up with land that basically nothing grows there.
Right.
Horses, the wild horses don't have that same effect because they actually did roam in areas in Eurasia, very similar, the ancient steppe horses and that sort of thing. You know, and the reason the cattle interests want them off, it's the same thing that they do with the wolves in Yellowstone or the American buffalo in Yellowstone. They claim, you know, that they spread brucellosis or that the wolves are eating their cattle, and even though they're paid for them, you know, should it happen, you know, they don't care. They like the caller said, they're in effect wanting all this land for themselves. So really there should be none of these animals on federal land because they're really destroying the soil and the native plant.
Well, and increasingly that's what's happening, Carol. And my opinion is that this is the consequence of the droughts driven by global climate change, and that nobody's just saying that out loud, that in federal lands in several states in the Southwest, the BLM is dialing back on the number of animals that they will allow to be grazed on these federal lands because they're damaging the land. And I would think that's probably because there's not enough water there anymore.
Yes. It's more of that issue than really looking at, one of the reasons Ted Turner built that huge herd of buffalo at one time, and I guess he still has them, I don't really know. He had a massive amount of buffalo, and one of the reasons he did that was to have them out on the plains, in essence, bringing those plains back to life.
Right.
By regenerating the soil. The soil of the plains is not really farming soil. It won't really support that.
Right. It's grassland.
Native grasses and plants that a lot of other animals can subsist on.
Yeah.
That are native, animals.
Yep. Let me, by the way, just something you may find fascinating. Go to YouTube and type into their search engine, how wolves change rivers. And
okay.
It is this fascinating little 10-minute YouTube video that is just, it's A, inspiring, and B, mind-boggling, how wolves change rivers over at YouTube. Carol, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. And Howard in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Howard, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Howard.
The Republicans have a lot of think tanks.
Yeah, they do.
And those think tanks, that's where they come after the working poor, the middle class, and I don't know why the Democrats at least have one think tank.
Well, the Democrats have some think tanks.
And I want to nominate you on that think tank.
Okay, thank you.
Howard Dean and James Carville.
Okay, there are some left-leaning think tanks. I mean, the Center for Economic and Policy, CEPR, whatever it is, Dean. I'm forgetting his last name, but anyhow, he's there. You've got Robert Reich. Well, actually, Robert Reich is associated with UC Berkeley. But there's Center for American Progress, of course, another big one. But good point, Howard. It's the thing is, you don't have. See, when billionaires invest in right wing think tanks, they get their taxes lowered and their pay goes up and their ability to hide money overseas is increased. When billionaires invest in left-wing think tanks, their taxes go up and their ability to evade taxes goes down. And so there's not as many billionaires or multimillionaires who are willing to invest in left-wing think tanks. I mean, it's just the sad reality. Gordon in Spokane, listening to the web stream of AM 950 in Indiana. Say, Gordon, what's up?
Hi, Tom. My question is... basically, I support the Affordable Care Act overall. Not a perfect law, but I wanted single payer, but I do support the law. But my question is, what do you say, and also so I can know what I can say to these people who say they don't want to pay for the so-called moochers? They don't want to pay for somebody to get free Medicaid.
Right. There's a very simple answer to that. Do you want the person, the moocher, sitting on the park bench next to you to be coughing with tuberculosis that you can catch from them, or would you rather that they weren't?
Right.
I mean, there's a public health dimension to this, which is the main reason. This is how a national health care program was sold by the Kaiser in Germany in the 1880s. Germany was the first nation to have a national health care system, and it was because of the tuberculosis epidemics. It's like, let's get everybody covered because the rich people don't want to be walking through the streets and having the poor people coughing on them. And in this era of, dangerous influenza epidemics and things, I mean, don't you want everybody to have access to health care so you don't have to worry about getting sick from
them?
You're
listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, of all issues, health care is the one that's most easily answered that way. Easily. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dave, watching Free Speech TV in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin. You wanted to get to the Grazing Act of 1937. I didn't know there was one. Educate me.
Yeah, the Taylor Grazing Act.
Oh, the Taylor Act. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
37? I thought it was 34.
Sometime back then.
Okay.
Anyway, basically it says permits are, this is verbatim, permits are given for grazing a privilege, okay, not a right, okay?
Right.
And permits are required to pay a fee, and permits can be revoked. They only last 10 years. They can be revoked due to drought or other things that deplete the grazing lands.
Right.
And that's verbatim right out of the Grazing Act. So.
So all of our welfare ranchers, whether it's the Koch Industries, three giant welfare ranches, or whether it's this little mom and pop operation, the Bundy family, they're basically, you know, subject to 10-year renewals
That's what it says. They can be they only go 10 years. They can be renewed, but they can be revoked due to drought or depleting of the grazing lands. So
right.
that's the policy and.
Yeah,
you know the government's well within their rights to.
Yeah, sounds pretty straightforward.
Doing, so.
Dave, thank you for the call and thanks for sharing that. Susan in Wauna, Washington. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Just basically wanted to touch in on the topic of the rancher.
Uh-huh.
And basically on that situation, we had a similar thing of coming up on a vote here in the state of Washington regarding public lands.
Right.
And it was written kind of strange because I think actually what they're trying to do because of the forests that are no longer being used for lumber
right. Is
they're trying to kind of get a barometer of possibly fracking here because underneath the trees is possible usage of shale. And it's like, what would
really?
Be appropriate? Yeah.
Even in, I thought a lot of Washington was kind of volcanic land. I didn't know that there was.
Well, on Mount Rainier, when you climb the one side, the pinnacle side of Mount Rainier, that is all shale. So, I mean, it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And did you ever find out who Tom, I'm trying to, another person had mentioned him, Tom, the other rancher here that was funding to both sides. I'm trying to think of his last name right now.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head.
You didn't know. Okay.
Yeah,
I'm trying to find it.
So you think that you know, it used to be the wars in Oregon and Washington State, Northern California were all about public lands with regard to the paper companies and the timber companies wanting to get the trees, and you know now they're looking at the possibility of frack and shale out from underneath them. Is there?
So it would seem the way this bill was written, there was a lot of things on this ballot. This last election, even the GMO was not even correctly being addressed.
Right.
And that was why I wrote the bill.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. Susan, thanks for the heads up on all that. I appreciate it. Thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We will be right back 10 minutes before the end. Hey, I want to know your take. So if you have a comment or question for our radio or TV show, grab your phone or turn on your computer, point the camera at your own face, hit record, and send your videos to yourtakemytake@gmail.com. Don't want to be seen on TV? Then leave a voice message on our rant line at 202-536-5306 and tune into The Big Picture every Thursday night for our Your Take, My Take live segment. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. Back in 2002, when George W. Bush, or was it very early 2003? I think it was 2002, when George W. Bush said to the to Mullah Omar, the Taliban in Afghanistan, when Mullah Omar offered to arrest Osama bin Laden and turn him over to a third country for trial, and George W. Bush said, nah, I'd rather bomb your country. Back when that happened, as soon as we started bombing Afghanistan, I was saying, Obama, or excuse me, Bin Laden just won. And Keith in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening to AM 950, you apparently want to say something similar to that.
Yes, indeed. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Keith.
Thank you for what you do.
Thank you for calling.
Keep speaking to the truth.
I will do it.
Snapshot. Osama bin Laden issued a fatwa, 98 time frame,
right,
that he was going to destroy America.
Economically.
Financially.
Yeah.
Economically. 2004, we had 9/11, Katrina, two wars, medical D, jobs going overseas.
Right.
From 2004 and 2008, the GOP started initiating a Sharia law, anti-woman, anti-minority, anti-voter, initiated shutdowns.
Yeah.
From 2010, they ran on the aspect of jobs. What did they do? More anti-woman, voter suppression.
Yeah, and anti-job stuff. I mean, the sequester killed lots and lots of jobs, and et cetera.
No help for Sandy victims.
No help for the long-term unemployed.
And under the guise, the GOP said that they were going to make the president a one-term president.
Right.
They said they would use terrorist tactics to do so.
Well, sort of. Pete Sessions said that they had to think like the Taliban. He said they had to become an insurgency like the Taliban.
Right. So now we have the TP party, or the group, the Wing Nuts, were involved from 2010 until today. What has been the issues? Cut services, stop integration, stop health care, the Ryan budget, Keystone, and now they almost are stoking a war in a sense that they're pitting us against each other this badly. Osama bin Laden is dancing a jig and a two-step in hell, or wherever he is.
Yeah.
This is so, so wrong.
Yeah, I totally agree with everything you said, Keith. I'm right with you. Thank you for listening to AM 950, and thanks for calling. Carol in St. Paul, Minnesota, also listening on AM 950. Hey, Carol.
Hey, Tom. Oh, just quickly, BLM, they actually gave birth control to the horses. They cut them back, but it's the ranchers like this cuckoo bird in Nevada that want the horses off the land.
Hmm.
But the other thing is, I think you brought up the middle class. I think when we started buying into the middle class, that everybody was middle class, that's when we lost the war.
Yeah. Yeah.
But as far as this, this whole Bundy thing, my head is going to explode because you've got people with guns. You've got Sheriff Mack. You've got Richard Viguerie defending a freeloader, and yet the people in Nebraska who own their land and don't want the XL pipeline to go across it, nobody says a word.
Right. Or the people in Oklahoma who own their land and their homes and just want to put solar panels on the roofs are now going to get taxed for doing it because the oil.
Is it being able to hold two contradicting thoughts into your brain at the same time, or not recognizing that you have two contradictory thoughts in your brain? Is that what it takes to be a conservative?
That's a good rhetorical question, Carol. Maybe even a good literal question. I think it takes a certain level in today's America, by the definitions of today's conservatives, I think it takes a certain amount of willful ignorance. Yeah. Carol, thank you very much for the call. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia, listening on Sirius. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, I think we've got the bad land management because according to Alan Savory, and I did some more checking on him, and I really can't understand how you can say he's been debunked. He's actually been reinforced by a lot more.
Well, no, let me just clarify and explain for people who don't know what you're talking about, Steve. Alan Savory is a guy who claims, and there's a viral TED Talk that he gave that you can watch, who claims that if we just returned the buffalo to our grasslands and did so in a big way, that would sequester enough carbon that it would stop global warming. And it would sequester an enormous amount of carbon, and it would be a very beneficial thing, but it's not going to stop global warming. And that's my point. His claims are true, but his claim that this is the solution to everything, that's hyperbole.
Well, if you just do it on a small area like Africa, but if you utilize the entire surface of the Earth as a sequestering...
ain't going to happen.
...for carbon. Well,
with 8 billion people, it ain't going to happen.
Sort of like the trick. But plus, the fact is because of bad land management, it is producing more CO2 than all of the factories and the cars and the fuel that has fossils in it and all this kind of stuff. In other words,
Did you see the Showtime special last weekend on Sunday?
Actually, no, but I will look at that.
Yeah, you can find it online. It's interesting. This is James Cameron's thing. 15% of all the greenhouse gases are just coming from deforestation. That's pretty startling. Steve, thanks for the call. Thank you for being with us today. Don't forget, we need 150 more names to get Bernie Sanders that signature, those 10,000 names on that signature, to tell Bernie to run for president as a Democrat. You can sign up for that over at pdamerica.org. And you could even join me up in Massachusetts on May 10th for the 10th anniversary of PD America. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.